Two readings in today's service are taken from Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. They're each from a section called Divine Will and the Laws of Nature. And I like this because this first story comes from India, a nation to which I devoted quite a bit of attention in my studies of world religion. Before the age of human awareness, according to the ancient Hindu text of India, Manu, the all-knowing, was seated in contemplation when the great man approached him and asked him, "Please, Lord, tell us precisely and in the proper order the laws of all the social classes, as well as of those born in between." Manu proceeded to tell of a time when the universe, as we know it, was in a deep sleep, and the one who was beyond the range of senses brought forth the waters and took birth as Brahma, the grandfather of all the worlds. And then, to fill the land, he created the Brahman, the highest caste, from his mouth, the Kshatriya from his arms, the Vaishya from his thighs, and from his feet, the Shudra, the lowest of the four Varnas or divisions of man, millennia ago and into the fullness of time. The fragment from which each caste was formed foretold the position that each would fill and their placement in order in the caste system. From lowest to highest, bottom to top, the Shudra, the feet, the servant, the bearer of burdens, the Vaishya, the thighs, the engine, the merchant, and the trader, the Kshatriya, the arms, the warrior, the protector, the ruler, and above them all, the Brahman, the head, the mouth, the philosopher, the sage, the priest, the one nearest the gods. The Brahman is by law the Lord of this whole creation, according to the laws of Manu. It is by the kindness of the Brahman that other people eat. Unmentioned, though, among the original four Varnas were those deemed so low they were beneath even the feet of the Shudra. They were living out the afflicted karma of the past. They were not to be touched, and some not even to be seen. Their very shadow was a pollutant. They were outside of the caste system and thus outcasts. These were the untouchables who would later come to be known as Jatis, the subordinate caste of India.
Our second reading today is an excerpt from the section on the Western world. In the words of the sacred text of the Western world, the Old Testament, there had been a great flood. The windows of heaven had opened, and all of humankind was said to have descended from the three sons of the patriarch Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, who would become the progenitors of all humanity. One season, Noah planted a vineyard, and he later drank of the wine of the vineyard. The wine overtook him, and he lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, who would become the father of a son, Canaan, happened into the tent and saw his father's nakedness and told the two brothers outside, Shem and Japheth, took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. They walked backward into the tent and covered their father's nakedness. Their faces were turned in the other direction so they would not see their father unclothed. When Noah awoke from his wind and found out what Ham had done, he cursed Ham's son Canaan and the generations to follow, saying, "Cursed be Canaan, the lowest of slaves will he be to his brothers." The sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth spread across the continents. Shem to the east, Ham to the south, Japheth to the west. Those who decreed themselves the descendants of Japheth would hold fast to that story and translate it to their advantage. The Spaniards, the Portuguese, the Dutch, the English. And thus, a hierarchy evolved in the new world they created, one that set those with the lightest skin above those with the darkest. The curse of Ham is now being executed upon his descendants, Thomas R.R. Cobb. A leading Confederate and defender of slaves wrote 240 years ago in the era of human bondage in America. The great architect had framed them both physically and mentally to fill the sphere in which they are thrown. His wisdom and mercy combined in constituting them thus suited to the degraded position they were destined to occupy.
A never-ending quest for self-improvement. I'm grateful to accept the invitation from Reverend Steve to be in your pulpit, your virtual pulpit, because in the brief time I spent with you, I grew to love you. And I arrive knowing that you are one of the UU congregations that has made great progress with coming to grips with racism in America. Love and loving one another is a fundamental of our faith. I recall shifting toward love and loving when I was in junior high school. I was raised in a small Iowa town, and my church had former members who led a summertime program for students in Harlem. These exes of the church and my church decided to offer these students a chance to see rural America. So they brought them by bus to Iowa. I'm rather grateful that I was not the bus driver for that trip. Rudy took that ride. My age, he stayed at our next door neighbors, but he and I spent much of that week together. I took him to parks, ball fields, the town square, post office, library, creeks, pastures, down by the railroad tracks, the pool hall. We covered all the bases. And his urban zeitgeist congealed with my small town outlook. It pleased us both. I appreciated him, grew to love him, and was sad when it was time for him to go. Race and racism is a difficult topic for white Americans to contemplate. But like Pete Carroll, and I hope some of you might have watched that video. If not, go back and take a look. He was solid. Like him, I am curious, and I know that there is always more to be learned. So I took note when Oprah Winfrey invited people to read Cast, saying, Cast should be required reading for humanity. It eloquently examines the unspoken caste system that has shaped America. Ever since my days with Rudy, I thought of racism as similar to casteism, so was delighted to pick up a book by an author who dug into this topic more deeply than I have. And so, Wilkerson writes this in the introduction to the Pillars of Caste. These are the historic origins. The pillars upholding a belief system, the piers beneath the surface of a caste hierarchy. As these tenets took root in the firmament, it did not matter so much whether the assumptions were true, as most were not. It mattered little that there were misperceptions or distortions of convenience, As long as people accepted them and gained a sense of order and means of justification for the cruelties to which they had grown accustomed, inequalities that they took to be the laws of nature. And there are 8 pillars of caste shared by Wilkerson. And I want to offer them to you. And I hope I don't sound a little bit professorial in this, but I think that these pillars are important and show an inclination, a tendency between casteism and racism and an attitude toward life that was for a while in Nazi Germany. The first pillar, divine will and the laws of nature, offers 2 slants on the religious, as Joe Campbell might say, the stuck metaphors that frame the Indian and American caste systematics. You heard it earlier, the Manu and Noah myths. The second pillar is heritability. Ever since 1662, enslaved women in America always gave birth to slaves. The 1662 Virginia legislature, comprised primarily of slaveholders, wouldn't you know it, legislated that any child of any enslaved woman would be slaves for wife. Now, if they, the owners, had fathered the child, it made no difference. That child was not the heir to an inheritance. That child would be a slave for life. That convolution of the Noah metaphor became Virginia law in 1662. That's pillar 2, heritability. Pillar 3, endogamy and the control of marriage and mating. Here I quote Wilkerson. Endogamy, restricting marriage to people within the same caste, was brutally enforced in the United States. It was the primary means of keeping resources and affinity within each tier of the caste system. Those in the dominant caste see those beneath them as less than human, an enemy, not of their kind, a threat to be held in check at all costs. In 1940, a Southern physician told researchers, "You know, the Negro race is inferior mentally." "Everyone knows that," he said. "And I don't think God meant for a superior race like the whites to blend with an inferior race." Well, that's 1662 to 1940, but it has gone on. Pillar 4 is purity versus pollution. In our country, racial segregation has made a strict appearance in hospitals, ambulances, hearses, cemeteries, railroads, buses, schools, churches, textbooks, clothing stores, jails, and courtrooms. The white avoidance of pollution was so strong that courtrooms had black Bibles and white Bibles. Swimming pools and beaches were segregated too. In 1919, 17-year-old Eugene Williams unwittingly crossed the invisible line separating the black water and white water in Chicago's Lake Michigan. Eugene Williams was stoned and then drowned for that offense. Pillar 5, occupational hierarchy. The Jatis and the Mudsills. In March 1858, Senator James Henry Hammond of South Carolina addressed the U.S. Senate. When a house is being built, the most important piece of the framework is the mud sill, the sill plate, which bears the weight of the entire structure above it. In a cast system, the mud sill is the bottom cast that everything else rests upon. At the bottom, like the feet. All social systems, said the senator, need a class to do the menial duties, the drudgery of life, a class requiring but a low order of intellect and skill, the very mud sill of society. You know, shortly after the Civil War, the state of South Carolina prohibited black people from any labor other than farm or domestic work, taking a step to re-establish them in the position of occupational mud sill. Pillar 6, dehumanization and stigma. Human society has in-groups, and some of those in-groups dehumanize out-groups. This is difficult on an individual basis. Therefore, groups are chosen for dehumanizing. One consequence of this is that the in-group begins to see not only that the out-group is a little bit less than them, no, the out-group becomes the worst of the worst. In America, the slave auction, the persecution, the punishment, and the microaggressions of today are all still a part of that very similar historic dehumanization of people of color in the United States. Pillar 7. Terror as enforcement, cruelty as a means of control. This is where the power comes. The way to keep sentient beings in an artificially fixed place is with violence and terror, psychological and physical, to preempt resistance before it can be imagined. The whip was the most common instrument of punishment. Nearly every slaveholder used it. Few grown slaves escaped it entirely. Homicide, rape, and assault were cultural transactions that were felonies in the slave era. Wrong, immoral, reprehensible. But the country allowed almost any atrocity to be inflicted on the black body. Think about this. 12 generations of African Americans faced the ever-present danger of assault and battery, or worse, every day of their lives during a quarter millennium of enslavement. For each of these seven pillars, as it is in India, so it has been in America. And if we were to stop here, I'm sure some might say, oh, those are the old ways. It is not that like that anymore. And I would just have to say, sadly, we see forces moving back in the direction of the oppression that we have seen for far, far, far too long. The difficulty is that the first seven pillars, religious framing, heredity, endogamy, purity versus pollution, occupational trauma, dehumanization, and terror led directly to pillar number 8, and inherent superiority versus inherent inferiority construction, motif, way of being. And my Unitarian Universalist friends, this is where complexity creeps in for us. Because the eighth pillar of caste, its summation, is antithetical to the first UU principle. The inherent worth and dignity of every person is not equal to and could never be equal to an inherent superiority versus an inherent inferiority motif. Sadly, many of us, and I count myself here, have failed to see that eighth pillar, first principle, split. Perhaps because we have not looked at this in terms of viewing it as a system of caste and caste oppression. Just as many liberal religionists, and I'm speaking here particularly to white liberal religionists, have missed seeing America, the land of the free, the home of the brave, this land that we love, as an incubator for supremacy. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. explained a difficulty that he saw many years ago. He said the white moderate is the Negro's greatest stumbling block in his stride toward freedom. The white moderate is more devoted to order than to justice. The white moderate prefers a negative peace, the absence of tension, to a positive peace, the presence of justice, and I would add equality, and I would add compassion, and I would add mercy and tenderness and love in our hearts. Oh, the comfort of an absence of tension, the negative peace, says King, has allowed many to overlook the whole system, these pillars of caste upon which the American racism has been constructed. Meanwhile, brothers and sisters, our brothers and sisters, for we are all brothers and sisters in this interconnected web of all existence, suffer through a quarter millennium and more, and still pushed down by the systemic forces of oppression that continue to surround them. I have an example. I have shared the story of Rudy several times in my ministry. That 1962-63 experience was a pivotal moment in my life. But I forgot, had completely forgotten a piece of that story prior to reading Caste. My parents and I had discussed my plans for the week prior to Rudy's arrival. They made me sit down and have a little talk. Some of us had those when we were growing up. When they asked me what I was going to do, one of the things I said was, we'll go swimming, which meant go down to the municipal swimming pool. I was advised against that. Some of the other town kids would not like swimming with someone from Harlem, is the way they put it. And I knew what they meant. I had not even met Rudy, yet my empathy for him and his situation arose, and I said, that's not fair. You're right. But if the kids in town are upset, they'll go home and then their parents will get upset, and the whole purpose of this trip could unravel. Can you feel the absence of tension here, friends? Yet, as I talk about it now, I feel a tension in my shoulders, more so as I recall that I had forgotten that whole incident until I read about what happened to Eugene Williams when he slipped over the invisible Blackwater-Whitewater divisor there in Lake Michigan. Caste is a powerful book. It is filled with stories about from the struggle. It's told very well. It's not told like a professor or written like a college textbook. Many of these stories are wrenchingly difficult to read, yet throughout rippled with waves of wisdom. Light bulbs kept popping off as my head as I read that book. As a friend of mine has said, Isabel Wilkerson's book should be required reading for every teacher, lawyer, judge, social worker, politician, and anyone else that pretends to support the values of U.S. democracy, our Constitution, and human value. We just looked at a small section of this text. I shared this with you, intending to open our eyes to caste and casteism and think perhaps a little bit differently for some. And then for others, just something to digest and to work through. I would hope eventually so more of us can confront the difficulties that we face in our society. This is a tough time. We lost a champion, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, was on the forefront of fighting for justice and equality for everyone, women for sure, but not just women. It went beyond that. It went to all of us. It went to the universal human race of which we are a part. Let me close with this. I know they say don't say this as Unitarian Universalists, but every black church I've ever been in, they say, let me close with this. And then sometimes the minister goes on for 10 minutes, which I won't do here. An election is approaching. An important election. This is a time to share and spread the inherent worth and dignity of every person, far and wide. This is a time to share freedom, equity, and justice in Washington and throughout the land. Thinking back, I recall that I door knocked in Bellevue in 2018. I will not be there this year. I'm wondering if you could help out with the local door knocking effort. I wonder if you could make some calls for UU the Vote. I wonder if you could find a local candidate or a proposition and ask how you can help. What I really wonder is whether East Shore Unitarian Church could double your congregational outreach for this election. Double, triple, make a difference. Move from 10 to 20, 25 to 50, 50 to 100, 150. Through it all, sharing with the world that you love and appreciate the inherent worth and dignity of every person, and that you pray every day that others will do so too. If you can take this step and others take that step along with you, inherency and dignity and respect for the human family will win this thing. Win it. How about it? Are you game? May the spirit of love be with you always, reaching out and building up the love in the hearts of those around you. Amen. Ashe. Blessed be. Let's do it. Namaste.